is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore on CFRU 93.3 FM. Today I'm talking with Owen Roberts, and Owen Roberts works at the University of Guelph and has a blog called Urban Cowboy, which is a city view on agri-food, as well as writing for papers such as the Guelph Mercury. And Mr. Roberts has written extensively on agricultural issues over the last several years. And I'm looking forward to have a very interesting conversation about agri-food issues with him. So, Owen, how did you become involved in writing about agri-food issues in the first place?
Well, it started out because no one else wanted to. No one else wanted to write about agri-food issues, and now I'm going back, Walter, I'm going back to the, late 70s, early 80s. And, you know, agriculture was farming, and it wasn't really food, even though it seems like an unnatural disconnect. Back then, things that were going on in agriculture weren't considered to be either of interest or applicable to urban people. And I was a journalist, and still am, and I was asked, because somebody had to write about agriculture, and they said, hey, how about you? You're from the country. Why don't you write about agriculture? So I said, yeah, okay.
And so you're from the country. Where exactly are you from originally?
I'm from Mitchell's Bay, and Mitchell's Bay is about as big as your nose. It's about 300 people down in near Chatham, actually, Ontario, down near Windsor.
Okay, and what's the primary form of agriculture down there?
Well, it's corn and soybeans and some beef cattle, but some vegetables. It's down in that very very fertile ground that used to be a lake bed, and now it's really, really fertile ground.
So a lot of heat units down there, so you can grow corn quite successfully, I guess, down there.
Absolutely.
Probably field tomatoes as well, too, I'd
imagine.
Tomatoes,
yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
And peppers and all those things that break your back, or used to break your back when you picked them.
Right, okay.
As a kid.
So you say someone asked you to write about agricultural issues. What publications did you start writing for?
Yeah, so this is for the weekly community paper down near, it was in Wallsburg, actually.
Okay.
Which is where I went to high school. And then
okay.
I went back, and that was my first job, was with the Courier Press weekly newspaper in Wallsburg. And then I went out to Alberta, as a lot of people did back in the 80s, and got a job out there with a weekly. Then I got a job with a magazine in Edmonton. And that's really where I started to take off writing about agriculture.
That's a very different form of agriculture out there as opposed to Ontario, too.
Yeah, you would know that. Actually,
yeah.
I read in your bio you were growing tomatoes in Alberta, is that
yeah,
correct?
In a zone 2B where they said it couldn't be done commercially. Yeah, we were growing on contract for Delta Hotel chain, and that was quite interesting, really trying to push the limits, and we had to do a lot of things to help the plants grow and reach maturity so that we could give our produce. We were selling on contract to them, and they wanted to have local produce actually on their menu, and they were in the Rocky Mountains, and we were about 2 hours drive away, so it was quite challenging. But east of there, then you've got the prairies, and it gets really hot in the summertime, and a lot of grain growing, a lot of cattle farming, and I imagine that's, you wrote a lot about that, I guess.
Yes, it was canola and wheat and cattle, that's for sure. That's what I wrote a lot about. But
right.
But I think one of the neat things about local food is there are these microcosms, these little pockets here and there of local food. And I guess, you know, when you're trying to define what local food is, you know, it really depends on where you're at.
Right.
And doesn't
That's true. You have to work with what you have, you know, from the climate, from the soil type, from the water availability. I guess also people's personal preference as well. Many factors. And sure. That's part of the ethos of this show is to talk about that and get people's stories about that. Now, you're at the University of Guelph. How did you mm-hmm. come here and what do you do here?
Mm. Yeah, well, I came from Alberta. I was working for a magazine there, and as I said, I was writing about agriculture, and someone who was attached to Alberta agriculture, the provincial ministry, came to work for the University of Guelph, looking after the agreement that the university has with the Ministry of Agriculture, Food and Rural Affairs for research, and decided, why don't we bring a journalist in to write about the things that are happening research-wise? Somebody who can... And now this is called knowledge translation and transfer. Back then it was called explaining science.
Right.
And the goal here, I came here on a one-year contract 23 years ago.
Right.
And just to try it out, because no one had done this before. Guelph was really forward-thinking, as was the fellow who came here. It was Dr. Jim Mahone, who's a faculty member in environmental design and rural development. Came here and saw the need to communicate about agricultural research to people outside of agriculture, inside of agriculture too, but more broadly because of this investment that was going into the university from the Ministry of Agriculture, so therefore taxpayer dollars.
Right.
And the information that was coming out was going pretty well to farmers, but wasn't going to the public. And that's why I came here. So that's what I do. I try to make research understandable. And I've got a student writing program that's done well. It's called SPARC. It's an acronym for Students Promoting Awareness of Research Knowledge. And now we train students about how to write about science and communicate that broadly.
It's interesting because I'm taking a course called The Business of Science, which is, I guess, a result of a joint project and scholarship between OMAFRA and the University of Guelph. Mm. And I think that's, you know, the whole aspect of communications, but also the aspect of science actually translating research into something that's commercially viable. I think that's I guess where they see the future, where I see the future, certainly. One thing is interesting. I certainly see that the amount of extension positions has been reduced dramatically, you know, with government cutbacks. So do you find, in a way, you serve an extension capacity because you're communicating to people, whether they be growers or not, what's going on with respect to research?
Oh, absolutely. And I think extension is, you know, how you define extension. How I've always defined extension is, in a lay kind of way, is extending information from a source to a user. And that whole pathway from the source to the user, to me, is extension. So when me or my students are creating science news, research news, and getting it out there, that to me is extending knowledge.
So,
and now with social communication, we can actually get some feedback other than letters to the editor, or, you know, there's a good way now to get feedback about what's going on.
So if you can give me some specifics as to what you would write about and what the students would write about as part of this SPARC program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we have arrangements with folks like the Grain Farmers of Ontario, the Milk Producer Magazine, the Guelph Mercury will run our stories pretty well verbatim because they're written in a journalistic style. And so recently we've been writing about, well, the big announcement the other day that was here about the bean gene program, in which Professor Peter Paul is the chair of Plant Agriculture, is defining the bean genome. So we'll write about stories like that.
Right.
And when we write for the Grain Farmers of Ontario, we'll do a lot of how-to stories. You know, try this technique, and a researcher at Guelph, at Ridgetown, at Alfred, at Kempville has tried this technique, and this has been the outcome. So in that way, that's much more like classic knowledge, knowledge transfer and translation.
So as well, you've got the blog Urban Cowboy, and the website is the URL is http www.urbancowboy.ca. And what has been the response to the blog?
Well, the blog, I use the blog as a tool, and I would suggest others do this as well if you're in this position to do so, to drive readers to another source that can be longer information. I don't think a blog should be any more than, you know, maybe three paragraphs. I think that's what people have the appetite for. And so I use it to drive people to my Urban Cowboy column, which is in the Mercury every Monday. But I guess in the response to that, I started on that column 20 years ago now, and I'm still doing it. So I guess that's one way of measuring response. Are you still employed, right? and I'm still, even though, you know, I mean, I don't consider the Mercury really an employer, I consider it a great opportunity to tell people what's going on up here, and to raise issues and to promote dialogue. And I see some letters to the editor in the Mercury periodically that suggest that we're promoting dialogue. And, you know, I take a position, which I think a columnist has to do. I'm writing a column here, so, you know, a column should, I think, take a position.
Okay.
So I take a position, and not everybody agrees with it, but that's a democracy, right?
Right. Well, absolutely. Yeah. I guess I think about some of the articles I've read that say, oh, the blogosphere is dead, or it's dying a slow death, and it'll be done in a couple of years. What, your perspective with your blog, what do you see?
Oh, I think it's a riot. I love having the blog because, you know, it's a combination of pictures and stories and immediacy.
Right.
And it's the beauty of citizen journalism. It gives everybody a voice. Yeah. I love it. And because it's got, because it has the opportunity for feedback as well. You can feedback immediately.
Do you get a lot of feedback from your blog posts?
No, not a great deal. But, you know, I get a few people telling me I'm crazy. I get the odd one saying, hey, way to go.
Right.
The biggest response I get, or I have received, it hasn't had anything to do with food. It was about coyotes. I write about coyotes, and people just, you know, I wouldn't say they line up to give their opinion, but there certainly seems to be some strong opinions from people about, you know, a coyote ate my dog, saw a coyote out there, you know, mulling about, you know, eyeing my cat. And then a lot of how-to people coming in saying, here's how I got rid of coyotes, you know.
Yeah, it reminds me when I was in Alberta growing, and we had a problem with Richardson's ground squirrels. And,
oh, yeah.
And then a family of badgers moved in, and that seemed to take care of the problem.
Yeah.
I guess because you've written so much about agricultural issues over the last years, what are some of the most significant changes you've seen in the agricultural industry?
Well, I think the biggest change, at least I'm thinking here from a consumer's perspective, because what I really do, I do write for farmers, but I think I write about agriculture for a broader audience. And it's the interest in agriculture that I think is the biggest change, the interest that's taken place by the public. I think that's precipitated by a lot of things people are realizing, and I think the agriculture industry is getting better at promoting itself as a source of environment, health, communities, all those other good things that that seem to be associated now more so with agriculture than ever before.
Okay, we're going to listen to Tana Sliman and her CD Lucky Blue, and she has a track on here called My Bike.
Yeah,
sorry. Yeah, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah, so, sure.
I've been doing this for about 3.5 months, and I still really find there's so much to get do away with the friend whose hair was red out of town. For speed ahead. Democracy Now is the show that comes after my favorite. On the way to going and back on the old abandoned track. Didn't think we get that far away.
Troubles that we got is the lake we pull aside, keen to get.
think this is going to be it as long as I can.
Was told between us two, with every mile we chased the blues away. They couldn't hide underneath the summer sky. Could have stayed at home in bed with a pillow around my head, but I got on my bike today and see the world differently.
Anyway, that's good. We're going to talk about the local food in Kansas City. And that was Tana Sliman with her song My Bike off of her CD Lucky Blue. So, Owen, I wanted to ask you about the local food trend. And I was listening to the radio today, and Grower was talking about how in the last couple of years a local food trend has really taken off. And I know from being a grower and growing actually operating my own CSA and also growing on contract for chefs, that certainly it is prevalent, and there's certainly a very devoted following to it, however large or small that may be. What's your perspective on it, and why do you think it's become so prevalent?
Yeah, I think there's no question it's prevalent. When you look at the popularity of the farmers market downtown and the activity at the Jesuit Center, I think Guelph is way in front. I think it has been in front because of this relationship that Guelph has had traditionally with agriculture, particularly, again, because of this connection that the university's had with the Ministry of Agriculture to develop new varieties. You know, when you look at some of the varieties that have come out of Guelph over the last 100 years, the crop varieties in particular,
right?
It's amazing, and Guelph has had such an impact. The researchers have had such an impact, and that's been, sanctioned and supported and funded by so much to an extent by the Ministry of Agriculture. So, and what were Guelph researchers doing? Providing food for the people of Ontario. What is food for the people of Ontario? Well, that's local food, right? We didn't call it local food, or they didn't call it local food way back then, but that's really what it is. And once again, it kind of goes back to that definition when we were talking about Alberta. You know, to people in Alberta, grain is local food. Cattle is local food. It's grown near them. It's grown in their locality. You know, how do you define that local food? Is it? I think, thankfully, it's gone beyond the 100-mile diet to be defined by a lot of other things,
right?
Such as your community. If your community is broader than in your mind, it's broader than 100 miles, or if it's smaller than 100 yeah. miles, that's your community.
I think the whole idea of externalities has really come into play. They might not define it as such, the word externality, but I think people realize that, why should I buy, something offshore that comes thousands and thousands of miles if I can get the same nutritional value from something that's grown locally? Maybe that'll help the apple industry in this province in some respect, with new varieties, but also with heritage varieties as well, too. That remains to be seen, but I appreciate what you're saying about, not being restricted to 100 miles. I mean, 100 miles is just sort of initial baseline to take a look at.
Yeah, it was a good start. I think it was a great start. It gave us, 100 miles, I can envision that, kind of.
Yeah.
100 kilometers or
yeah.
whatever it might be.
Well, the whole aspect of what is a bioregion, how do you define local, right. you could have a spend hours debating mm-hmm. that.
I think the point you make, though, is really good as far as people enhancing their education of food. I think the local food movement has really done that. It's really helped people want to understand more about what's going on local farms. And I think that's great for agriculture, because then it'll also help them understand that we need policies to preserve that farmland. And then we need not only policies to preserve the, you know, geographic bounds of the farmland, but to preserve the integrity of the farmland, like the soil. You know, what is going to be done to make sure that not all the good organic matter isn't carted off to be made into something else, that it needs to, some of it needs to go back into the soil to keep the soil, you know, healthy.
I think we're seeing that more and more, that perspective, that understanding,
right.
I know in my own research here that we're looking at how do you maximize what you get out of a plant. You know, it's not just, the kernel of grain, but it's other aspects of the plant tissue as well, too, that you can use that, beforehand might have just been wasted or trucked off, but now has actually some benefit. And yes, it could be compost, but it could be more than that as well, too. It could potentially produce biofuel. It could have some medicinal nutraceutical property as well, and so I think we're starting to see interdisciplinary research more and more because of that whole aspect of what you just said.
Yeah.
Now, on that note, and it's a good segue into this next question, is do you think biotechnology and sustainable food production, can that actually coexist? It seems that there will always be a faction of people that, for whatever reason, are opposed to biotech, and or in certain cases, I guess, some kinds of biotech being implemented in food production. So do you see that that can coexist?
Well, I've never really understood why people thought biotechnology is unsustainable. I mean, it's a form of technology. And again, if people accept that technology, if you just don't like technology, then, we're kind of, there's not much more.
There's a non-starter there. There's no discussion.
Yeah, you can't have much of a discussion or a conversation. But if you look back and see what technology has done in, some primitive forms, like bringing forward new varieties of crops and all the other good non-agricultural stuff that comes from it, like health-related, medicine and all this kind of stuff, then you can see some, maybe you don't have such a negative view on technology.
It's funny, you say that because I don't think anything's been, a friend of mine said that these are his words, nothing's been fornicated more with than the Macintosh Apple, so it's quite interesting because breeding has, we've always tried to bred for disease resistance or increased yield or cold tolerance. So, you could argue that that's biotechnology. What is your definition of biotechnology? Again, I find it a very interesting question. And then my next question, really, you've written about agriculture for many years, and I'm thinking about the fact that there are less people than ever before involved in agriculture, yet an increasing number of people we've just discussed are concerned with the food that they put in their mouths. What do you think can be done to close this gap, or can it be closed as an issue?
Well, I think things like this, and I think, columns and newspapers, and that, this whole knowledge translation and transfer movement that's going on right now to bring answers, to raise, get the whole transparency thing in there so people can understand what's going on behind the scenes in labs, in fields. I think that's a real fascinating part, is in fields. What's going on there? How do you get people to understand what farmers are doing? Because now they want to know. And it's not hard to explain. And farmers are getting better at explaining it as well. The current generation, but also the new generation of farmers coming along with new communication skills, because they have to. In the old days, farmers didn't particularly have to talk to the public.
Right.
Now they do.
Yeah.
And so they're getting some communication skills, and, students leaving OAC here, coming out with some good communication skills. But, I think in this whole idea of biotechnology, et cetera, let's equate it to music, for example. We don't expect everybody to like the same kind of music, right?
Right.
We don't we don't think jazz people and folk people and rock people are always going to say, hey, yeah, that's a good song. So why do we expect there to be one universal acceptance of food?
Or one way to produce it, I guess.
One way to produce it. So, what's that about?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. I didn't think about it that relating it to music, but interesting analogy. Something else I really think is an issue as well, too, and it certainly has come up, the affordability of local organic food. I used to be a certified organic grower, so I completely understand. You know, there's a cost of certification and a cost of production that certainly has to be factored into your pricing. But there's no doubt when you go into the supermarket store, and I think milk is a perfect example of this, certified organic food can be much costlier than conventionally produced food. And depending on your situation in society, you may or may not be able to afford that food. So how do you think we can reconcile farmers getting a fair price for what they produce and at the same time making it affordable for consumers that would prefer to buy organic but may not be able to afford to do so?
Well, I think the key is to help people understand why it costs more. And then they can make the decision, I guess, about, you know, if they want to spend more on that because they believe it's supporting the farmer or it's doing whatever. If the farmer has to go to extra measures for whatever reason to produce this particular kind of food, why is that? And I think that's a matter not just related to organic, but to any kind of food. Local food, why does it cost more? Well, than imports. Maybe because the production practices here are more expensive. We pay more for labor, we pay more for this or that. But I think people have to know that.
I guess, you know, we've talked about several issues, and I'm wondering what issue if you could pinpoint one issue, what is the one issue you're most concerned with right now facing agriculture?
Well, there's the soil I mentioned before. The sanctity of the soil, I think, is a big one, because if soil is sick, nothing is going to be fed. Animals, people, plants themselves.
Right.
So I think that's a big one. But I also think, as far as local food goes, safety is it's a huge issue that I don't think, you know, there's this belief that there's a miracle of safe local food, and that local and safe are intrinsically tied. And I don't think they are. I think, you know, food is food, and it needs to be inspected. It needs to have people that are looking after the production of it and the distribution and all that kind of good stuff. And why would anyone think that something that's at the end of a lane, end of a farmer's lane, or wherever, is safe? Because it's grown locally? I don't think those two are absolutely connected.
Right.
And I think there needs to be a lot more attention paid to the safety of local food.
Right. It would be unfortunate if we saw a salmonella outbreak or something from let's say locally produced lettuce, for example, because proper cleaning procedures weren't followed, or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, and it's probably inevitable that will happen. I really believe food in general is really safe. I think it's incredibly safe. When you look at the amount we consume versus the amount of problems there are, there's certainly people who will, you know, raise those problems as, and reasonably so. However, when you look at it on the big picture, I think we have a very safe food system. I think common sense kicks in a lot. But I think overall, we're in great shape.
Well, I'd like to thank Owen Roberts for coming in to talk to us about agri-food issues and his blog, Urban Cowboy, and the work that he does at the University of Guelph.
This is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore, broadcast out of CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph, Ontario.